Okay, I would like to welcome everyone to the America Under the Gun editorial briefing with Mother Jones editors Mark Fulman and Dave Gilson. My name is Stephanie Green, and I'm the development manager here at Mother Jones. I'll also be moderating today's call. Today, we'll be discussing a topic that tragically made multiple headlines last year, gun violence in America. Long before tragedy struck in Newton, Mother Jones reporters and editors were raising awareness to the realities of gun violence in America. Mark and Dave will discuss our coverage of the gun control debate, as well as our ongoing coverage that became an editorial priority long before Newton. I encourage you to ask questions and create a dialogue on this call. We do these briefings to give you, our supporters, an inside look behind the scenes of Mother Jones. Our journalists are busy in San Francisco, DC, and New York covering the latest breaking news or in the field working on deep dive investigative assignments. While the end result is award-winning journalism you've come to know, love, and support as a reader, you don't often get the story behind the story. How do we get the lead? What did it take to break the story before anyone else? And how do we ensure our reporting will have the greatest impact? We'll discuss all this and more on today's call, but before we begin, let me remind you of a few housekeeping items. All callers are muted. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 9 on your phone. When you have been unmuted, you will hear a prompt that you have been released to speak, and I will ask you to introduce yourself. We welcome and encourage questions at any time throughout the briefing, but we will also reserve some time at the end of the call for a formal Q&A. Please do keep your questions concise and avoid using speakerphone so that we can hear you best. If we do not get to your question during the call today, you will have the opportunity to ask them of Mark or Dave later on via email. So that's it for housekeeping, and let's get started. Do I have Dave and Mark on the line?
Yes.
Yeah. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Dave and
Hello,
Mark.
Hello, everyone.
Okay. Well, the first question, let's go to you, Mark. You've really been spearheading a lot of the coverage that we have been doing, mostly online. And while the Newton tragedy turned the eyes of the nation towards gun violence, Mother Jones has been reporting on gun violence and mass shootings even before the horrific event. Can you talk a little bit about how this coverage got started and how we've developed a gun desk beat over the last year?
Sure. We started the project investigating mass shootings last July, on July 20th, when the massacre happened at the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. And when the news of that emerged, we started asking the question, how many times has this actually happened? Because it seemed, you know, all too familiar in the headlines. And we took a look and discovered pretty quickly that there wasn't any good data really at all out there on this type of event, these public mass shootings that kept happening, you know, since Tucson and then Aurora and many times before that we'd heard about. So we realized pretty quickly that we would need to develop a way to gather that data. There also wasn't really good criteria for it, which is probably why no one had done it. There isn't really an official definition of mass shooting. So we started talking with criminologists and law enforcement experts and just started digging. And within a day, we had put up an interactive map that we called a guide to mass shootings that tracked, I think we started with about 26 cases across the United States in the last 30 years. And within a few days, we'd done a lot more research and heard from various sources. And we had a map then detailing about 60 cases. Of course, we couldn't have predicted that the big events that would have followed that. But, you know, shortly thereafter was the Sikh temple shooting in Wisconsin. There was another mass murder in Minneapolis in September. And then, of course, Newtown in December. So at that point, we'd had several months to look into this particular issue and had really found a whole host of interesting things. We looked at a variety of state gun laws. We looked at the spread of weapons, how many guns had the number of guns, how much it had increased in the United States, where it had become easier to buy them and to carry them in public, et cetera.
Great. You mentioned that we sort of had to create the database because no one had pulled that data together before. Can you talk a little bit about how we chose to define what constituted a mass shooting?
Sure. Well,
and how maybe that's evolved?
Yeah, I should make clear that the data was out there. It's just that nobody had gathered it, in part because it was difficult to find. Data on guns and gun violence is notoriously difficult to come by. A big reason for that is because of the way that the law works. There's been a number of laws put in place that have made it difficult to do research on gun violence. The gun lobby has been behind a lot of this stuff, shutting down research by the CDC. Gun violence statistics are pretty general. So what we did was there's a set of data that the Justice Department puts out on gun violence that's pretty broad. Some of the criminologists we spoke with, that's essentially what they used to study the issue. But we were particularly interested in looking at these events that happen in public. So we wanted to define a more narrow set of criteria. So we excluded cases that involved gang activity, for example. We excluded armed robberies. We excluded domestic violence, mass shootings in people's private homes, because we really wanted to focus on movie theaters, shopping malls, schools, workplace shootings. So we developed the criteria around that. And a key parameter was looking at the number of fatalities being four or more in a shooting. It's somewhat of an arbitrary number, but it's generally accepted as a baseline for defining a mass murder. There was an FBI symposium on mass murder in 2005, where they gathered a who's who of law enforcement experts and criminologists and talked about mass murder in terms of four or more deaths in a single event. So we used that as a baseline and then studied these events more specifically by location. And as I mentioned before, excluding those other primary motives, gang violence, robbery, et cetera. So that's how we came up with the set of cases we studied. And we ended up looking at 62 mass shootings in the last 30 years. A couple interesting things we learned from the data. One was that these types of mass shootings were occurring more frequently in the last few years. 2012 was a record year for them. There were seven last year alone, with a total of more than 140 victims injured and killed. So the data told us a lot of interesting things by our narrowing the focus to this particular kind of case. We were able to learn quite a lot. Oh, and one other key point that we learned from it too was that most of the killers obtain their weapons legally, nearly 80% of them. That's what in part prompted us to start really looking at gun laws, to see why it was so easy for these people to get their hands on weapons.
Great. So we had all of this data, which is sort of an incredible amount once it was all compiled. Dave, could you speak a little bit about how we chose to present the data in a compelling way, drill down, and make it more easier to digest for readers?
Yeah, we presented the data in a variety of ways. We did a number of charts and maps, that gave people a lot of different entryways into it. Likewise, Mark and his team have written numerous articles explaining what's in the data, their analysis of the data, and really laying out an argument based on the data. And finally, we've made a lot of the data public, so anyone can look at it. They can, spot check it, use it in their own reporting. And as we've seen, the data is being cited widely. By a variety of places. Today it was cited by Dianne Feinstein at the assault weapons hearing. This is something we've done with a lot of our data projects is, really slicing and dicing it in, half a dozen different ways and giving people a lot of different ways into it.
Great. So as you said, it has been cited multiple ways, most recently today in the hearing. We've also had some places such as the Weekly Standard have sharply criticized our approach. Can you talk a little bit about what the general reception has been to our coverage and why you think it's received this level of attention on a topic that's receiving a lot of media attention across the board?
Would you like me to talk to that or?
Either one of you.
I'm happy to talk about it. Yeah, overall, I think the response has been really positive because of some of the reasons Mark outlined. First of all, we were the first people to really compile this data in a consistent way and present it in a form that a lot of people could use it and cite it. and, you know, getting beyond anecdotal type evidence, which is a lot of the evidence in the gun arguments. You know, it certainly has gotten pushback, like you said. You know, one of the big arguments that Mark has gotten into with people who've questioned the data is, you know, based on our research, we found that in all of these mass shootings, civilians with guns didn't stop any of them. And that counters a big argument we've heard post-Newtown, which is, hey, you know, the only thing stopping a bad guy is a good guy with a gun. If that good guy is not a cop or a member of the military, they have a very poor track record of actually stepping in and stopping mass shooters. And again, that's backed up by the data. And so that's been one of the main criticisms is, well, how did you come up with that figure? Aren't you trying to prove a negative? But again, I think the data has been put together in a way that's very consistent, and our definitions of how we you know, look at it, again, are pretty solid.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, too, that you know, while that criticism was there, because we went so deep on this project and focused on it for so long, we actually looked far beyond the data set of just the 62 cases that we studied. We looked at a lot of other shooting rampages as well to answer some of these broader questions about how gun violence works and how it can be stopped. And so in answering that question about, you know, do armed ordinary citizens stop mass killings, we looked at a whole host of other cases as well, and found that it happens. It's attempted very, very infrequently, and it's been successful even more rarely. So it wasn't just with the 62 cases we studied, but in fact, almost any public shooting that we could find in the last 30 years, there really isn't a single clear example of an ordinary citizen with a gun stepping in and stopping someone. So I think, you know, it's been an important part of this project too, has been debunking misinformation that's out there too. The pro-gun lobby and the NRA do a tremendously effective job of putting out misleading information. And Dave's also done a great work on that too, debunking a number of the myths that they rely on to push their agenda.
Well, thank you for that setup, Mark. That was my next question for Dave. Dave, you did do a special you did a special piece on many of the myths about gun violence, particularly that a good guy with a gun will stop a bad guy with a gun. What do you think the media has done well with Newtown coverage in debunking these myths or talking about gun violence? And what do you think it can do better when it comes to reporting on gun violence and gun regulation in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, I think what the media has done well is, at least for, you know, the last couple of months, it has entertained, you know, a new spate of critical reporting on guns, and particularly looking at gun laws and how people are obtaining guns. I think a number of the myths, though, the general myths that have been there for a long time are still out there and are pretty hard to counter. And I think, you know, some of these myths, the idea that, you know, a gun actually makes you safer, or that guns protect women, or that guns are used in self-defense millions of times every year. Some of these things have been out there forever and can be hard to, you know, respond to, because, like Mark said, so much of the data on guns is so general and doesn't out there, or it's contradictory. And that is the result of, you know, about 20 years of the gun lobby putting restrictions on the type of data and research that can be done. So I'd say there's a lot more reporting that can be done, specifically on the issue of, you know, how guns really are used in self-defense. And that builds off of the arguments we've been having about guns being used to stop mass shootings as well.
Great.
Absolutely. I think also, Stephanie, I was just going to add one other thing is that, you know, you'd asked before about the reaction to our work, and particularly on this notion of debunking myths and putting out good information, good data. I think, you know, it's sort of the ultimate compliment to your work when organizations that wouldn't typically be interested in it pay attention to it. And we had Fox News was interested in the project. I went on there with them and talked about it. We've had some interesting pushback, but also recognition of our data set from outlets like that. So it's, I think, a really a nice testament to how much our work has had to say on this issue.
Great. I want to remind callers that we are open to questions at any time. All you need to do is dial *9, and I will release you so that you can ask your question of Mark or Dave. Mark, going back to the reaction that folks have had, can you talk a little bit about how gun control activists and survivors of mass shootings have responded to this reporting?
Sure. Well, we started hearing from them very soon after we launched the project in July, and that was really interesting for me in particular, just to hear the perspective of shooting survivors. I mean, it's of course quite poignant, but they also have some really interesting insights into the way gun violence and mass shootings in particular are covered in the U.S. media, and also, you know, the notion of how quickly people seem to forget them until they happen again, and that the way that cycle plays itself out. So, for example, I heard from a shooting survivor from Knoxville, Tennessee, who was in a church in 2008 when a man walked in and killed a bunch of people. And he was pointing out to me how even 4 years later, a lot of people in his community barely remembered that it had happened, which I thought was really interesting. Another thing I heard from a shooting victim that really struck me was from one of the survivors of the Virginia Tech shooting. She had seen our reporting and reached out to me. I had a chance to meet and talk with her. And, you know, this was later in the fall, and I was aware at that point, you know, the ways in which our work had been successful, but I wanted to hear from her, you know, what else were we missing? What else could we be doing? And one of the things that she said to me that really resonated was that, you know, the media is often overly focused on the killers. And this is something we know, of course, from watching television coverage in the immediate aftermath of these events. And, you know, we in our research at Mother Jones had certainly focused on the killers to some degree and the weapons they used and their mental health profiles, et cetera. But we also felt that it was important to focus on the victims and their stories. And so when I heard this from the Virginia Tech survivor, it just kind of clicked for me again. Yes, we should really pay attention to this. So after Newtown, we decided that at that point, when it had just become abundantly clear how terrible last year was for mass shootings, we thought, okay, we're going to take a look back at all of the victims of this type of gun violence in the last year. And we quickly assembled a team of about 9 staffers, Dave, myself, and our interactives team, some of our editorial fellows and reporters. And we gathered data on 151 victims of these shooting rampages over the entire year, and did sort of mini obits about them, or in the case of survivors, you know, mentioned something salient about them, and just, you know, put this all together into a kind of interactive gallery on our site. It was modeled in a loose sense after the Portraits of Grief project that the New York Times did in the wake of 9/11. And it just became this really powerful document of all the people, you know, the names and the faces and the stories of the people who had suffered from this issue. It was very hard to do. I mean, it was grim stuff to sift through and look at and stare at for days, but we felt that it was important. And, in the back of my mind, the whole time that we were working on it was the words of this survivor, Christina Anderson from Virginia Tech, just saying, look, you know, the victim's stories are important too. So I think that's another aspect of the project that I'm quite proud of, that I think, you know, we did something there that no one else has really done on this subject.
That really is a moving piece. We do have a question. I will remind you to please introduce yourself.
Hi, this is Paul LaForte from Chicago. My question is, looking at the 1,001 things that need to be done, do you have an idea about what are the 5 most likely, or the couple most likely to pass into law, and which are the couple most unlikely to pass into law?
I'll respond to that. So thanks for your question. You know, it's very hard to speculate about what may or may not really happen on Capitol Hill. I think the legislation that's being discussed there today, Dianne Feinstein's bill, I think, you know, overwhelmingly the view is that it's not likely to pass. Banning assault weapons and high capacity magazines has a very, very tough battle. But if you look at the polling that's been done, particularly since Newtown, there is growing support among the public to deal with gun control. to adopt some more what people consider to be reasonable regulations, including potentially banning certain kinds of weapons, certain kinds of high-capacity magazines. There's some debate about how those things are defined, which I wrote about, again, this morning in a piece we have up today about those particular types of weapons. So the issue of what to do about the weapons is a tough one. I think there's some possibility that high-capacity magazines, there may be some activity there in terms of new legislation. Outlawing types of guns, I think, is going to be difficult. But then beyond the weapons, I think there are a number of things that can be done that may be more likely. Most of them, I think, were covered by President Obama in his recent public comments about what he was going to do using executive branch power to promote, for example, more serious research now with government agencies, basically saying, you know, to the CDC and the NIH, like, go ahead and actually study guns, which was, you know, essentially a pushback on legislation that was put in place a number of years ago at the behest of the NRA and their allies in Congress that basically put a kind of a chill on it. It didn't explicitly ban government research on guns, but it put a serious chill on it by suggesting that it couldn't be done. So I think research is one area. I think better enforcement of laws is something that I think we'll start to see, hopefully. I mean, gun prosecutions have been low for a long time and have actually been lower under the Obama administration than prior presidents. And part of that, of course, is because the federal agency that is directly tasked with dealing with the issue, the ATF, has been essentially neutered by past laws. They don't even have a permanent director. They haven't had an appointed director for, I think, 6 years now. Mm-hmm. So there's some things with enforcement and regulation that I think are more realistic in the near term. What happens in terms of Congress passing laws around weapons is hard to say.
And the background check issue is big, too. And it seems like there is
some
momentum from unlikely you know, supporters in Congress, including, you know, some pro-gun Democrats who said that they support universal background checks, which would obviously close this enormous loophole, which has been called the gun show loophole, but it's really the internet sales loophole that, you know, allows people to buy guns from folks who aren't technically gun dealers. And this accounts for, you know, somewhere in the range of about 40% of gun sales. And, you know, closing that would, in theory, mean that, you know, all guns that are purchased legally would require the buyer to get a background check.
Yeah, and I think
actually,
go ahead, Dave.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, I was going to mention one other story
Sorry.
It's all you.
I was just going to add to on the background checks that is viewed by many people as possibly the most realistic or the most probable legislation to pass, and even that alone would be a significant change.
Yeah, I was just going to mention one thing. We had an interesting story by one of our reporters, Josh Harkinson, here in San Francisco, who wrote about some of the bills that are being proposed in California, which go beyond anything that's being proposed in Congress. And obviously, California in the past, just by virtue of being such a large state, has often driven the way for, you know, legislative changes or, you know, changes forcing, say, manufacturers to make changes based on the California market. So there are some bills here, such as, you know, taxing ammunition or other regulations that, you know, if they passed at this state level, would have a serious impact nationwide as well.
Yeah, also the liability insurance question has started to gain some traction, which is interesting. The basic concept being that gun owners would be required to carry insurance the same way you have liability insurance to drive a car. When that idea first came on the scene, I don't know, a month or two ago, it didn't strike me as something that would get taken very seriously, but lately we've seen it being reported on more, you know, in the major newspapers, and it seems to be an idea that's on the table.
Great. Thank you so much for that question. Once again, I'll remind callers that they too can ask a question or a follow-up question by dialing *9. While we're on the topic of gun laws, maybe we can go back to the gun laws that have been passed to deregulate guns. One of our stories noted that there have been 99 laws rolling back gun control legislation since just 2009. Could you give us some highlights, or perhaps lowlights is a better word, of how gun control has been chipped away?
Sure. That was kind of an offshoot of the data project, where we looked at state laws that had been passed in recent years. A lot of them, somewhat under the radar. I mean, they were known locally, but no one, as far as we could tell, no one had done a story pulling them all together. So we did another interactive map showing a number of these laws that had passed, and we broke it down into three categories: laws that either made it easier to possess or buy guns, laws that made it easier to carry them in public, and laws that made it harder for the government to track guns. So just a few examples of that that stood out. In Virginia, a law was passed in the last couple of years that basically made it no longer a requirement for licensed gun dealers to report sales of handguns. And that was something that Virginia had required previously. Now they were taking away that mandate, and they also mandated that all prior records of those sales had to be destroyed. So you can imagine what that does in terms of law enforcement's ability to track weapons when they're used illegally. Another couple of examples, there was a bill, it just gets more into the category of crazy. In Missouri, there's a bill that allowed people to carry firearms. If they had a concealed carry permit, they could carry firearms in public and be intoxicated, as long as, I mean, the bill specifically said it was okay to be intoxicated as long as the person carrying the gun was not acting unlawfully or negligently. And they were also allowed to fire in, quote, self-defense. Kansas passed a bill allowing guns to be carried in K-12 schools, on school grounds, inside school, kindergarten classrooms, at events. Related events to the school. So, you know, things like this have been going on over the last 4 years across dozens of states, and we basically gathered them all together and drew a broader picture of a legislative landscape that has really become much more permissive in the last few years in terms of guns.
Great. Dave, you recently did a piece on sort of debunking the idea that most people that carry guns or own guns are hunters. Could you talk a little bit more about the difference between folks who own guns to go hunting and the folks that are owning these high-capacity assault weapons, and how that is being incorporated into the debate?
Yeah, I was really fascinated by this. I think when a lot of us think about legal gun use, we think about people hunting. And I looked into the data, and it turns out that hunters are actually a very small proportion of the overall gun owners. There's approximately 80 million Americans who own guns. But overall, about 5 to 6% of Americans have actively hunted in the last year. And then if you look into the reasons that people are buying guns, the primary reason is they're claiming it's self-defense or protecting their home. The number three reason is target shooting, and hunting is the number four reason. And likewise, if you look at the reasons that people are buying AR-15 type, military type rifles, hunting is, again, it's fairly low down on the list, which I think is really interesting, because again, this gets to one of these perceptions we have of how guns are used in the U.S. And it's really, I think it's obviously changed a lot in a generation or two, where, guns used to primarily be used for hunting and recreation, and now it's more for self-defense. And that explains a lot about the tenor of the gun debate, and also explains a lot about the way that the gun lobby has shifted its arguments. It doesn't talk a whole lot about hunting anymore, even though that's a big part of its history, but it really has focused on protecting handguns and assault rifles. And those are also happen to be the two biggest markets right now for guns in the U.S.
Great. Okay, we actually have two questions right now. Once again, if you could please introduce yourself.
Hi, this is Kim Keller in San Francisco. And I was just wondering, given all the talk about the mental health aspects of, that's sort of been linked to these mass shootings. Do you have any plans on, to focus on this issue, and how, what angle would you take to cover that? And, how do you get to that?
Sure. Thanks, Kim. I think, well, we have covered it to some extent in the mass shootings investigation. It's a very complicated problem. I actually participated in a panel discussion on this too a couple months ago that was really informative for me too, with the other experts involved. There was a leading psychiatrist from University of California, San Francisco, who specializes in mental health and the law. We had a veteran FBI agent there to discuss it. One of the takeaways was you can look at the issue of mental health with violence and recognize that it's prevalent with this problem. I mean, that was certainly clear from our data. More than half of the cases we studied involved shooters who had some kind of mental health problems. I believe it was 36 of the killers committed suicide at the scene. So a lot of these are murder suicides. That said, as Dr. Binder from UCSF pointed out, the vast majority of people with mental health problems are not violent, and that's very important to keep in mind. So then the question becomes, well, how do we potentially identify and stop these people from killing? It's a very complicated question, and it has to take into account a number of things, from medical ethics to civil liberties to access to weapons, just to name a few. So the mental health issue is something that we're very interested in here and are continuing to look at, but it's very complicated. And I think it's another area where more research needs to be done, along with a number of other complex social or socio-political issues around gun violence. Another one, of course, being violence in pop culture, video games, and movies. There really is no good research on these topics that connect them significantly to gun violence. So to begin to answer the question, what do you do about it, or how do you frame it and write stories about it, really goes to the question of a lack of good research, for starters.
And I was going to add a related mental health topic that we do have a reporter looking into is the use of guns in suicide. Of the about 30,000 Americans who are killed by guns each year, 2/3 of those are gun suicides. And there is a body of research out there that explores the links between having a gun and your likelihood of committing suicide. And that obviously, more people are dying from, firearms that way than, say, in mass shootings. And obviously that taps into, the fact that so many Americans do suffer from depression. And there is a suggestion that, guns are used impulsively in situations like that, when, had they not been available, someone might not attempt to hurt themselves.
Thank you. We have one more question.
This is Paul from Chicago. Two questions. One is, have you got any early reading on the political fallout of the carpet bombing of the political candidate in Illinois that was a gun supporter by the Bloomberg PAC? And two is, if somebody in your house has a mental illness like the last shooter, and you do not keep your guns under with a lock and key, is the gun owner culpable?
Those are great questions. I haven't read a whole lot on the Illinois race that you mentioned, though. The one takeaway I saw someone mention last night was, it's too early to tell if that case is a bellwether for, say, Bloomberg's strategy of backing pro-gun control candidates, just given the nature of it being a, Democratic race in an urban area. So I think the question becomes, could he back candidates in more traditionally pro-gun areas?
Yeah, although I would add to that, too, that some folks I've talked with about what Bloomberg's doing, it's clear that he intends to do a lot more of that. So if what happened in Illinois is considered a success, or even if it isn't, I think, you know, the understanding is that he intends to spend a lot of money in the next election cycle to push back against the pro-gun lobby and the way that they use money in campaigns.
And I think broadly speaking, I mean, I think the interesting thing that Bloomberg may be able to do is fight the perception that the NRA cannot be defeated politically, which we actually saw in the past election. They had a very poor track record in terms of the candidates they opposed. You know, the majority of them, including most notably Obama, went on to win. So I think there's the beginnings of the thought that, oh, hey, I can go up against the NRA and I may not get taken out in my next election.
Yeah, that's a great point, Dave. And also, I think you're seeing the shift too in popular opinion. And you know, the polls are starting to show a real disconnect between, you know, the views of the majority of Americans, including gun owners, and the leadership of the NRA on these issues. And we've also done some deep reporting on the NRA and its leadership in the last few weeks, and found some interesting things there that continue to support the idea that, you know, the folks who are running the show there, not just the public face of it, Wayne LaPierre, but also the some of the board members that previously have been pretty hidden from view, are folks who, you know, surprise, surprise, have deep connections to the gun manufacturing business and are profiting from the sale of guns in a big way, you know, supporting the idea that ultimately the NRA is acting as a lobbying front for big business, and that it's the views that it's pushing are increasingly out of step with the public. So I think folks like Bloomberg and others, smaller groups, can look at that too and realize that the NRA is no longer this dominant monolithic power, although you'll still see it written about that way in the mainstream press.
And on Paul, on the question about being held liable for the use of your gun, I'm not aware of any laws or any cases in respect to that. That doesn't mean they're not out there. But that's a really interesting question. So it's something I'm curious about as well now.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any either, but I think that's also related to the idea of liability, requiring liability insurance that's on the table, that it would force people like that to be accountable legally in that situation.
Great. Once again, if you do have a question, please dial *9, and we will have you ask your question of Mark and Dave. Going back to sort of the less data-driven reporting, we are actually working with a Newtown resident and artist to preserve the 500,000 letters sent to Newtown. Can you talk a little bit about how that project fits within our larger coverage in the Mother Jones mission?
Well, like Mark said, you know, a lot of what we're trying to do is also remember the perspective of the victims and, you know, paint as broad a picture as possible of, you know, gun violence and how it affects Americans. And like you said, one of our contributors, an artist named Ross McDonald, lives in Newtown, and I believe his daughter goes to the school there. And as you mentioned, you know, about 500,000 cards and drawings and all kinds of, you know, notes from well-wishers came in following the massacre, and the city literally didn't know what to do with all these things. So he's helped put together a project to try to archive these, and we've been working with him to create a digital archive. And you know, beyond any of the politics, you know, in shootings or, you know, the gun debate, it's really just a powerful, moving picture of, you know, people's responses to this tragedy. So if you haven't checked it out, I really recommend you set aside some time and, you know, hankies to check it out. It's really cool.
Can you talk a little bit about how we chose to present that information? It's actually housed on a Tumblr that's associated with Mother Jones, and how that's been received.
Right. So it's not based on our site. It's on a Tumblr. So it's easy, you know, so it's in a bloggable, shareable format. you know, it's driven by the images, so you can really spend time browsing and look at the individual messages that are on there. So it's not, you know, it's not just a Mother Jones project. It's supposed to be something bigger than that.
Great. Okay. Well, once again, we'll ask the callers if they have any questions to please dial *9 and give folks a second to think. I know this is a complicated issue with lots to untangle. Looks like people may have had all of their questions answered by you guys already. We have covered a lot today. And once again, looks like we have one more question.
Hi, this is Kim again in San Francisco. It's been amazing the coverage that you guys have done and sort of covered all aspects of this. But what's next? This Tumblr thing is an incredible project, but sort of, you know, not to predict the next mass shooting or anything, but where are you going to go with this?
Yeah, there are still, we have a long list of stories and subjects that we want to keep looking into, you know, short-term and long-term. Obviously, we're going to continue to look into the gun lobby and specifically the NRA and try to dig up as much information we can about, you know, how they raise money, who's really calling the shots there, what they've got planned in the future. You know, likewise, we, in terms of online projects, we're working on an interactive right now that, you know, looks more specifically at how gun violence impacts people depending on their demographic profile. You know, again, we talk about these things in very general terms, like, oh, the average American, you know, or the number of people who are shot every year. But when you really look at it at a individual level, it affects some Americans much more profoundly than others. So those are a couple of projects we're working on at this very moment.
We have one more question.
Paul again from Chicago. We have a strong interest in this in our area. I guess the question I would have is the liability thing seems to be really of interest, and I would suspect one of the first things an insurance company would do is say, if you have a weapon in a house with somebody that's mentally ill, you have to keep it under lock and key or the insurance is not going to cover you.
Yeah, I don't know that it would be insurance companies that would lead the charge on setting the policy, but certainly, you know, it's an interesting idea, and it's a tricky one too, because you're talking about combining it with an industry that, you know, whose goal is to make money. But I think if policymakers think about it carefully and construct a regime that makes sense in terms of trying to ultimately diminish misuse of guns, there's probably a way to do it that also is, you know, a model that works for insurance companies to profit from, because that's what they do. I think ultimately you'd be trying to create a set of rules that, you know, essentially forces people to take better care with their weapons in terms of, you know, who's got their hands on them. I mean, that would seem to me to be the main thrust of it. So in that sense, yes, you know, that approach could work.
Mm-hmm. One more question from Paul. Looks like a follow-up.
Just to follow up on that, I don't see why that would be anything different than auto insurance. I mean, you have to carry auto insurance, and the auto insurance guys will not insure anybody that's under 16, for instance.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the biggest obstacle to it is political, obviously. There's an enormous political interest that would line up against that as quickly as they have against everything else, because it's in their interest to have as much of a free-for-all with guns as possible. It's the best model for their business. But in terms of its practical potential, yes, I would agree with you that it makes sense in the same way that insuring cars, car driving does.
And I actually, we keep on talking about the data and the lack of data. And I think that actually comes back to some of the topics that were being explored and possibly will be again now that federal funding for gun research has been turned back on. One of the big questions is, you know, what are the risks versus benefits of having a gun in the house? And I think if there are some, if there's a preponderance of evidence that suggests, well, yes, having a gun in your house means you can use it in self-defense, but it actually makes your family and members of your family more at risk of being shot. I think that, you know, may create an incentive for insurers or lawmakers to take a look at that.
Right. I mean, in some ways, that is already well-established research, but if there
yeah.
were to be a new wave of it, that shows it, you know, more currently and expands upon it, then you could see that creating momentum for regulatory change like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, we are nearing the end of the hour. I'll have one more call for final questions. Again, just dial *9. I'd like to thank Dave and Mark for joining us on the call today. They talked a little bit about the coverage that you can expect to see in the near future. And of course, with the hearings happening as we speak, there will be coverage on motherjones.com soon, I am assuming. So it looks like we are out of questions. I will be sending a follow-up email to all of the callers today. So if you do have any questions that are still lingering, you're more than welcome to send them along to me, and I will forward them to Mark and Dave. I also welcome any feedback or thoughts on how we can continue to improve these briefings. And I will be sending a link of the conversation once it is available. And it would be more than wonderful for you to share with your networks and get this conversation started there as well. So once again, thank you so much for participating.